what does it really mean to love my neighbor? Is it the neighbor that looks like me? No. Jesus, pretty clear, it's the Good Samaritan. It's the person that's totally different from you. It's the immigrant. It's the refugee. And so if I really want to be a disciple of Christ, it challenges everything I believe as a white, privileged person, middle-class America. It challenges the way I vote. It challenges where I eat. It challenges where I do business.
Welcome to the Lead Like Jesus podcast. This is Karen Conley, and we are in for a treat today. I am in studio with my husband, Chris Conley, who is a trustee for Lead Like Jesus. And we have the privilege of interviewing a gentleman that if you don't know him, you will want to by the time we are done with our conversation today. And Dr. Larry Lloyd is with us. Dr. Lloyd, thank you so much for being here with us.
Great to be with you guys.
I was doing a little bit of research before we had this interview. Larry, if we went through the list of accomplishments that you had, we could use literally the entire podcast time. I want to just hit a few highlights. As we discuss this, there might be other things that are highlights to you, but you are the president of the Memphis Leadership Foundation that you began in 1987. You're also currently the vice president of Network Impact, and I believe also senior associate at Leadership Foundations, also an author of a book called Recovering from Racism, City Ministry in a Post-Racial America. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because from those organizations, you literally have impacted the entire city of Memphis. We are honored to have you here and to learn about your story and learn from you so that hopefully the message that we leave our audience today can impact cities all across this country and beyond.
And as someone who's had a privilege of knowing Larry over the years and knowing you through a lot of those ministries and a lot of those initiatives within this community, there's an enormous amount of respect in the city of Memphis. And for those of you that don't live in Memphis, I believe you're going to really hear some incredible things that find different expressions of that in your city or different ways that maybe you can initiate some of these programs where you are. So, Larry, we're so grateful to have you. And we know none of that would be possible without what God originally did in your heart. Really, the greatest accomplishment you have is just the way that you love people. Would you mind begin just telling us a little bit about your backstory before we dive into everything that God's done through you and your ministry? Just tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how God got a hold of your life.
Sure. I grew up here in Memphis. All my years, except for 6 years at Fuller Seminary, have been here in Memphis. Grew up as a privileged white kid, very middle class, and went to a very conservative evangelical church. So grew up with the gospel. But then something happened in 1968, April the 4th, 1968, when Dr. King was murdered here in our city. I was in high school at Central High School, and at that point in 1968, segregation was still the rule of the day in Memphis. Central was really the only high school that had much of any diversity. And because of that, because of Central's reputation as an excellent high school, as it still is today, a lot of the civil rights leaders' children attended Central. And I had the privilege of meeting them and building relationships. But I was actually on the baseball field practicing baseball when Dr. King was shot. We didn't know what had happened, except we heard sirens and helicopters. And as I got in the car, newly minted 16-year-old with a new driver's license, got in the car, turned the radio on, and heard that Dr. King had been shot. At that point, a crisis in my life. I'd been raised with the gospel, but the folks at my church and most evangelical churches absolutely on the wrong side of the civil rights movement, you know, called King a communist. Actually, they were celebrating his death. At the same time, I was friends with African-Americans playing basketball with friends of mine whose fathers were elders in their church, deacons or pastors who were sanitation workers. We worshiped the same Jesus, and so there was a total disconnect. I began to really explore the gospel very differently, even began to reject the Christendom that I'd grown up with. It also was in Young Life, you know. Central had a robust Young Life club, and there was a woman on staff there, her name was Linda McLeod, who saw my struggle. She said, you know, why don't you try reading the gospel as if you were black?
Wow.
Or as if you were a woman. So I read the gospel very differently, and I realized that Jesus was the most radical leader I had ever read about. By reading it that way, and reading it, and then I began to devour everything that Martin Luther King wrote, everything Malcolm X wrote, everything Rap Brown was saying. I began to really explore letters from the Birmingham jail. I mean, what a riveting story. And I began to realize that the Jesus of Dr. King was the same Jesus of the Bible, was the same Jesus I'd been raised with, maybe, but I'd been raised with a cultural Jesus. I had made Jesus in my own image, as we are wont to do. But I began to realize that the Jesus of Scripture, the Jesus of the Gospels, could not have been more radical. Martin Luther King didn't compare with that, I mean, in terms of his radical love for your neighbor and the poor and the oppressed. And I never read the Gospels that way. It became obvious to me that God loved the poor. Matthew 25 was not symbolic. Blessed are the poor. And Luke was not just a language for the spiritually poor, but the poor that were materially poor. I began to, as I said, devour these new works that I'd never read before. In fact, I tell folks when sometimes I teach, it was the autobiography of Malcolm X that was really a turning point. Mm. Because his critique of the black church and the white church was spot on. You guys have made God in your own image, not the Jesus of Scripture. And so April 4th, 1968 really began a pilgrimage for me. I went on to college at Rhodes. I always wanted to be a surgeon. I was in pre-med at Rhodes. But then I began some volunteering with FCA chapter Rhodes, all three of us. Played basketball. And if you had an FCA, I don't know if it's still the same now, but if you have an FCA chapter, you have to do community service. This was in the 70s, 1970 through 74. Memphis City Schools, after the killing of Dr. King, we had a huge white flight. Downtown was dead. The city school system lost all sorts of funding and money, so they had discontinued middle school PE and athletics. Our FCA chapter began to do six-period PE for the boys at Riverview Middle School, which is in South Memphis, and that changed my life. I said, I want to do youth ministry. So I started Urban Young Life when I graduated from college instead of going into medical school.
So, Larry, when I hear that story, it sounds like in many ways you use the term revolutionary in terms of Jesus. And there's a part of Jesus that really was also in that revolutionary way was a rebellion against the establishment. When you do that, most of the time you're not in the majority. You're in the minority. And it sounds like kind of a lonely place to be. We take from 1968 to 1974. I'm imagining that caused you to draw the line some. Play for us what that was like as far as you're devouring these books and you're becoming so committed to a new understanding of the gospel. But it doesn't sound like that there were a lot of adult influences or maybe even peer influences. What was that like for you during that period of time?
You know, Rhodes is an exciting place to be because there was a lot of social justice issues there on the campus. But there were a lot of us, white and black students. Matter of fact, Rhodes had a fairly robust African-American population in the 70s. So there were more people like me questioning the establishment. Remember, that was a Vietnam. That was a peace movement, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. All these folks had been raised in the South with the evangelical church, conservative Christendom. And so I was not really as alone as you might think. There were a lot of us exploring these ideas, exploring how do we live out the gospel in an authentic way in the face of civil rights, in the face of sexism, in the face of violence in Vietnam or discrimination. You're just coming out of Jim Crow, for crying out loud, in the 60s, right? I mean, there was still segregation. Communities were segregated. Schools, busing started in 72. There's more white flight. Christian schools, anti-bus, they called them CAB schools, Citizens Against Busing schools, crept up all over the city of Memphis. So the city was in turmoil. How do you parse this new reality when the establishment was totally opposed to change, as establishments always opposed to change? Yet there was a fairly robust college movement.
Larry, this is fascinating to hear from your perspective. I was born in 73, and Chris and I were talking the other day about how so many people have forgotten what happened. And I made the comment, but then there's so many who were not alive to forget it, but just don't have that orientation. It's encouraging to hear you weren't alone, but walk us back into your white evangelical church. How did that fit into, as you walked in those doors, what was the...
It didn't.
Okay.
So after college, I applied to come on the Young Life staff to start Urban Young Life in Memphis. Did so in 1975. And then 2 years later, with two other men, started the Neighborhood Christian Center. There's where, and my wife would tell you, we got married in 75, 42 years ago, and she will tell you that I was angry. Because what I was saying about the gospel and the poor, about inner city ministry, was really brand new. Urban Young Life was brand new. We started, and we moved into Orange Mound and started the ministry there. The historic Orange Mound is the Harlem of the South, right? I mean, it's the most famous African-American community this side of Harlem. So folks really kind of were puzzled. I was accused of being a social gospelist when I would say, well, the gospel is very social. All sorts of Rauschenbusch's social gospel went too far, but he was a corrective in a way. Put him in my dissertation because of some things he said. He was a corrective. The gospel is social. It is spiritual, but it's immensely social and immensely spiritual at the same time. You just can't ignore these passages in Isaiah or the Exodus story. I mean, it's loving the immigrant, the stranger. It's all there if you don't spiritualize it. The gospel is holistic. It's physical and it's spiritual. This was sort of new. There were people out there saying these things. Tony Campolo was saying this, Ron Sider, Jim Wallace, John Perkins, but they were the lone voices. Tom Skinner was a great fan of Tom Skinner. He was a lone voice. Bill Pinnell. These were all heroes in the evangelical. They were evangelicals, but you know, Bill Pinnell is one of my mentors. He just turned 88. Worked for him at Fuller Seminary. He wrote a book called My Friend the Enemy. He was talking about evangelicals. Mm. My friend, because theologically we're in the same camp, but I'm your enemy because you don't accept me because I'm an African-American and because we speak social justice. Yeah, Becky would tell you, I became very angry. I learned how to channel that, you know, as I did more theological study. But I was often quoted as calling people racist, and they were. But, you know, that's probably not the best way to win friends and influence people. So, yes, during those years, the evangelical church scratched their head. I remember one meeting with a couple elders when we went. Second Press was our first funder of the Neighborhood Christian Center, $15,000. I went to another church, First Evangelical Church, to match that $15,000 so we could actually hire a director because it just blew up. I mean, it was all volunteer, and all of a sudden we had 100 volunteers doing tutoring and after-school tutoring and job creation, job training. This thing really took off. We had to find somebody to run it. And I remember sitting down at Shoney's in Midtown with the pastor of First Evan and one of the lead elders, both who's deceased, and just trying to understand how this is Christian. How do you mix the gospel with job training or after school? How is that? Is it just a way to win converts, like rice evangelism? And I began to then figure out with Ron Sider and Jim Wallace and John Perkins how to parse this. That evangelism is one part, very important, it's crucial, but also job creation, economic justice, and so forth are equally a part of the gospel. And I remember just explaining that all day one Saturday morning over breakfast at Shoney's Big Boy in Midtown. Because it was so different for Southern evangelicals.
So from your perspective, both personally living through that, then all of the things that you've done professionally to be able to reform that, when you look back, what prevented people, and in particular white people in this particular question, from seeing the obvious and instead of being silent and passive, what prevented them from seeing it and choose to be more proactive instead of passive?
Well, I think you nailed it. It's fear. It's fear of change. What does it really mean to love my neighbor? Is it the neighbor that looks like me? No. Jesus, pretty clear, it's the Good Samaritan. It's the person that's totally different from you. It's the immigrant. It's the refugee. And so if I really want to be a disciple of Christ, it challenges everything I believe as a white, privileged person, middle-class America. It challenges the way I vote. It challenges where I eat. It challenges where I do business. Fred Davis, one of the first African-American city councilmen, is my mentor to this day. I have three mentors, all of them African-American, on purpose. So Fred, he always had what he called the check test. So you really believe in social justice, economic justice, let me see your checkbook. Where do you write your checks? Are you doing business with African-American business people? I'll tell you where your priorities are. I'll look at your checkbook. That's where it's challenging, because if I really want to be a disciple, of Christ. Of course, we'll never be what we want to be. Thank God that we're saved not on the basis of our works, but by grace. But it's radical discipleship. You can't read the scriptures and come away very comfortable.
Let's fast forward a little bit. I'd love to hear about the places where you think we have made significant progress, but then also to hear about where we've really not made progress and what needs to be done to not think just because certain laws have been passed that that alone is sufficient, but rather to say, no, this is still a significant problem that we have a proactive way that we can be a part of the solution.
Well, I don't think there's any question. If you look at Memphis in 1968 and Memphis in 2017, we made tremendous progress in so many areas: healthcare, Christ Community Health Services, Church Health, Neighborhood Christian Center, Binghamton Community Development Corporation, Memphis Leadership Foundation, Streets, I mean, and churches, Second Press, First Evan, Christ Methodist, St. Andrew AME, Mississippi Boulevard churches coming together to solve issues and to really take things head on. That didn't happen in 1968. I mean, there's never, that just didn't happen. So tremendous strides have been made in terms of race relations, social justice. Where we are struggling as we saw the backlash of these last elections and the rise of racism, anger that I think was beneath the surface, probably always has been beneath the surface. So we still got a lot of work to do. Our biggest challenges in Memphis, I think, continue to be our public education system and economic justice. There's African-owned businesses, wages for African-Americans, Latinos, way below the white population. So economic justice is a huge issue. In the past, we siloed these things, but now we're seeing businesses, donors, thought leaders working more cooperatively for what I call looking at the mega picture rather than the silos. So I have a lot of hope for the future, particularly with young leaders that are coming up to see the world very differently than our generation might have seen, maybe your generation.
Yeah.
Except when you were born.
One of the things that we say all the time, and as we talk to this particular audience, they're not just located in Memphis, but Memphis in a lot of ways can represent a microcosm for racial issues across this country. But we talk about the fact that you don't change a city by the existing leadership. You change a city by the emerging leadership. What are the one or two things that you would want to say to them as the younger audience up and coming? And then maybe if we have a moment for you to also contrast that with the generation before you. What are the things from your journey that you have learned for them to have a different perspective and understand the part that they play or how they can be a part of the solution?
Well, it depends on what kind of leaders. Let's talk about white leaders, either millennials or the 70-year-old. There's a dearth of understanding white privilege. If you're a millennial, you're an Xer, you're a boomer, or you're a 70-year-old, and you're white, you're privileged. And you just have to admit that. And don't deny it. Mm-hmm. Admit it. But here's what I would say. How will you steward your white privilege? You can't deny it. It's there. It's handed to you like, you know, an inheritance. Mm-hmm. My mentor, John Perkins, has said it this way. He said, white privilege, you're sitting on third base. Bonds is at the plate, and he's got a 0-3 count, and there's no outs. You're going to get home.
Yeah.
If you're African-American, Latino, a woman, Asian, you're starting at first base and you are got your ankles taped together and you're trying to get to third. Just admit that. You don't need to beat yourself up. No reason to be guilty about it because you didn't create yourself as a white privileged male or female. But then how will you steward that as a servant leader? How will you steward that in your church and in your home and your neighborhood? How will you lead as a servant to the poor? Because God's heart's with the poor. Am I not in touch with the poor, I won't grow in Christ. No way. Scriptures talk so pointedly about God's concern for the orphan, the widow, the stranger. If that's true, and I want to be like Jesus and lead like Jesus, where does my life intersect? Not in a paternalistic way, but in a servant way. So many leaders, millennials, 70s, Xers, whatever, lead from the top down. You can't lead that way. It's got to be from the bottom up. It's got to be with a servant's heart.
Dr. Lloyd, we have just scratched the surface. I know that Chris and I are sitting here with so many more questions. We would be honored if you would come back for a part two so that we can continue this dialogue. As we wrap up this particular podcast, really want to encourage our listeners, just a wealth of knowledge and firsthand experience. You have lived this out, represented in your book, Recovering from Racism. It's available on Amazon and most book outlets. Would encourage our listening audience to get that. And Larry, if someone wants to get in contact with you and learn from you.
The website is MemphisLeadershipFoundation.org, and our global organization is Leadership Foundations. We have foundations in 43 cities and 20 cities that are becoming foundations in Africa, Central America, Asia, as well as the United States. And so there's a number of other organizations doing what we're doing here in Memphis.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for the way that you have pioneered in this city, for the difference that you have made here. For our listening audience, we hope that you will learn from Dr. Lloyd. For more information on Lead Like Jesus, go to leadlikejesus.com, and we'll see you next time.